Hello and welcome to part two of Reclaiming the Divine Feminine, and today we're going to be looking at the creation stories and how we've evolved or not and how we got to where we are today. So in the beginning, there wasn't a word for religion, because according to anthropologists and people like the great mythologist Joseph Campbell, and I think is a very fair point, in the beginning we didn't see ourselves as being any separate from anything else. If there were gods, they were part of us. If there weren't gods, they weren't part of us. All of creation was part of us. We were an integral part of everything that was going on. And there was no word for religion in the very early languages, because you can't see something when you live inside it. If you remember, we were talking last week about three levels of evil. And when you're in the world or in the system, you can't see it because you're there. It's part of who you are in your very existence. So in the beginning, when we first became Homo sapiens, everything was sacred. Everything lived together in a cosmic dance. And the picture on the slide there is by the artist Bev Doolittle, whom I love. And she does a lot of art about hidden things, how everything melds together and works together in creation. And you can see in that picture there in the birchwood, there is a fox, that's quite clear to see. But in the trees, there is a horse and an Indian riding the horse. They're going from left to right. So have a good look in that picture until you can work out the differences, because the picture demonstrates perfectly that everything there is one. The concept of anything being separate is quite foreign. And that's how I believe we truly were at the very beginning. The first stage of the four stages of creation gods, according to Joseph Campbell, is the goddess alone. This idea of parthenogenesis, which is the idea of all creation just coming from the feminine. And the first stories, I'm going to quote from the Iroquois story of creation, but it's all the different stories of all the different peoples are the same story. They just have different aspects here and there, but the perennial truth is the perennial truth. So the idea is that the goddess fell through a hole into the great chaotic soup, the great cosmic goodness knows what it was, the thing before the Big Bang, if you want. But the creation stories always say there was a soup or something to start with, because you had to have the materials for creation. So the Sky Mother fell through some hole in some wall somewhere in the universe and fell down to this great chaotic soup. And the legend says that she was caught by geese and held down onto the shell of a giant turtle. And if you've ever read any of Terry Pratchett's Discworld stories, you'll recognise Greta Tuin, the cosmic world turtle. So Terry wasn't just making it all up. So the first goddess landed on the back of a turtle, and you'll see in the picture on slide number three that she's pregnant. Some myths say she was made pregnant by her husband, who then kicked her out of the heavens. Other myths say she was pregnant through parthenogenesis. It all depends where you came from. Anyway, she's brought down to the back of the turtle by the geese. And the creatures of the chaotic soup, the waters, if you like, and the creatures of the air know that she is the creatrix and that she needs something with which to create. So the sea creatures dive to get to the bottom, right down to the bottom, to pick up sand or gravel or mud to bring back something with which the goddess can create the world. None of them manage to do it apart from the muskrat. And the muskrat dies in the process. So his body floats up to the surface with some mud held in just one paw. And the goddess takes the mud and blesses the muskrat and uses that mud to create the whole of Earth. So the Sky Mother created Earth with the help of aquatic and semi-aquatic animals. And here's the great secret of it: she had seeds within her. We don't know if she was carrying seeds or these represent the seed in the uterus. But whatever happens, this story starts with the death of the muskrat. There was a death that meant the resurrection, the new birth could happen. And this is the deep secret of the goddess. She is involved with death and rebirth. And that, of course, is why one of the reasons why she's not that popular, because nobody really wants to think about death. And I'm going to quote Robin Wall Kimmerer, the author of Braiding Sweetgrass, which writes, such beautiful, beautiful text about the honourable harvest and getting back to the land and honouring the divine feminine. And Robin wrote, one woman is our ancestral gardener, a co-creator of the good green world that would be the home of her descendants. The other, Eve, was an exile, just passing through an alien world on a rough road to her real home in heaven. Look at the legacy of poor Eve's exile from Eden. The land shows the bruises of an abusive relationship. It's not just land that is broken, but more importantly, our relationship with land. We will be coming back to Eve's story next week. So let's just continue for a moment the first stage of creation. When Sky Woman has created this world and she's pregnant, so what happens next? She gives birth to her daughter. Now, some of the legends say she gives birth to twin boys, but I'm going to follow the one at the moment that says she gives birth to her daughter. Tekawaraqua, or Breath of the Wind, is her name. And that's important because the breath of the wind is Ruach. Ruach, which is the Hebrew word for spirit. Spirit, Ruach in Hebrew, is feminine. So we can start to see already that these stories intertweave, merge, meld together. So the Ruach is born from the sky goddess. And she, in turn, gives birth to twins and dies in childbirth because the twins fight inside her. And that's a direct parallel with the story of Rebecca in the book of Genesis, where she gives birth to Esau and Jacob, and those twins fight in her uterus. She survives, but in this legend, the fighting of the twins kills the mother while they're born. Some Iroquois traditions have the twins representing good and evil. All the traditions have them representing darkness and light. One of them is called Flint, and he represents destruction, death, night, ice, and winter. And the other, Skyholder, represents creation, expansions, life, day, and summer. Now, in some of the versions of the myth, Sky Woman favoured Flint, the grandson, usually because Flint deceived her into thinking that Skyholder, the other grandson, killed Tekawaraqua, and sometimes because Sky Woman herself disapproved of Skyholder's human creations and their ways. Again, the myths change and meld and merge, but basically Sky Woman does appear to support the darker side. Anyway, in the story, the twins fight. And this brings us back to Cain and Abel in Genesis, where Cain kills Abel. In this particular legend, the Mohawk legend says that Skyholder killed Flint by trickery. And the importance here is that Skyholder, the light one, the one that most people would support, the one that is bright and exciting and creative, the divine masculine, if you like, even though that seems the good one, it also carries evil within it. Both aspects, the dark and the light, carry the seed of the other in them. Just like the yin-yang symbol, each carries the seed of the other aspect within it. So whether it's good or evil, we don't know, but one of the twins kills the other. And that's how death and division come into the world through human violence. Now, in some of the traditions, Sky Woman is also killed. In others, she's turned into the moon. In others, Skyholder turns her body that dies naturally into the sun, the moon, and the stars after her death. And in still others, it's Sky Woman herself who creates the sun, moon, and the stars. But it all comes from Sky Woman. Now, wherever the healthy feminine is revered, in all the cultures where she was revered and where she still is revered, we can see certain patterns. There's equality between gender and races. Religion is primarily experiential and experimental too. There's dance more than dogma. Human population is limited because they know they don't have that much space and they don't want to overgraze or overfarm. the silence rather than learning. So it's going within, again, experiential, to discover what the link is within. And suffering has meaning. Suffering is seen as a way that we hone ourselves, a way that we learn how to grow. And suffering is also a sign that there's something that needs to be done. In the human body, when we experience pain, it means that our body is actually trying to heal. So pain is a good sign. Cancer, when it first starts growing in the body, you don't feel anything. You only start feeling stuff when the cancer pushes your organs or other aspects of the body to an excess of stress. So they are the things that hurt. The cancer itself does not offer pain. So suffering is incredibly important because it's a signal to us that there is a need to heal. Also in the Divine Feminine Law, L-O-R-E, all creation is valued, all creation is seen as being relevant and equal. And there is a focus on resurrection because death is a given. Everything dies and everything is resurrected. The cycles of life return. Under the law, L-O-R-E, of the Divine Feminine, we ask permission to hunt the sacred. And in the ancient days, they certainly did that. They asked permission of everything. And the hunter went down into the caves. We mentioned this last week. But they went down into the caves and they asked permission to hunt and kill. The image there is a reproduction of a Paleolithic cave, painting a bison from Spain about 20,000 years ago. And those creatures are represented after they've been killed because the artist would go back down into the cave and paint the creatures afterwards as a way of expressing the will to send them into the skies, to set the spirit free. So you'll see in that painting that some of the creatures are curled up, some of them are upside down, some of them are upright, but they're in the sky, they're part of spirit. So we would go down into the womb of the earth to obtain permission to hunt, and it was the goddess who decided whether we caught an animal and ate or whether the animal escaped and we went hungry that day. And that was totally accepted. That was part of the balance of life. It wasn't pleasant, but that was how it was. That was how life sustained itself. And here, nature is seen as being infused with a spirit or a divine presence. Everything is sacred. Everything is part of the one. And at the centre stage of this development was the main hunting animal culture, whether it's the bison for Native America or the eland for South African tribes. And a large part of the religion was to do with the tension caused by the necessity to kill versus the divinity of the animal. So that's why the animal was presented as coming from an eternal archetypical source, coming into this world as a winning victim, and with the understanding that their physical life would be returned to the soil, to the Mother Earth, and their spiritual life would be returned to the skies. And the Divine Feminine observes the honourable harvest. The honourable harvest is the tradition of reciprocal taking and giving and honouring the land. And as part of the honourable harvest, you ask permission before you pick or harvest or hunt. You ask permission from the fruit itself, from the tree on which the fruit is born and from the fruit itself. And you instinctively know whether you may pick that fruit. You never take the first fruit, because there may not be any more. If you only see one, you leave it, because that is the form of reproduction that makes sure that there will be food for next year. You also never take the last one, because something needier than you might need the last fruit. You never take more than half the fruits. Again, you'll want to feed everything else in creation. You always give thanks and you always give back. And that will be in the form of a gift of something like a pinch of tobacco or some oats. It was really important for reciprocal work to go on. Now, whenever the divine masculine is revered, and this is going to look a little bit negative, this is slide number 8 now, and I apologise if it does look negative, it's not meant to, but we are focusing on the feminine. When we are guided by the masculines far more than the feminine, the balance is out. Humanity believes it's superior to all other creation, and we know that that is the case right now. Humanity's creative and expansionist. Well, that's good. It's growing and expanding, but not always good. The feminine is seen as lesser and often dangerous because the feminine embraces death. We focus on power and we focus on overcoming enemies as part of that expansion. So anybody who opposes our expansion is automatically an enemy. Population growth is encouraged. Textual learning predominates over oral or experiential. We like facts in the masculine. We like it to be provable. That's where the whole of the Enlightenment and rationality came from. We didn't want any more myth or experiential stuff. We wanted plain, hard facts. So the oral legends were discounted as myth. And myth, of course, isn't anything to discount, but that's what we learnt that it was. And we prefer to have written proof. We defy and we deny death. We can see that all the time nowadays. And we focus on law, L-A-W, over spirit. You can see that in the Hebrew Bible, in the edited version of the Second Temple, where the Deuteronomical laws are far more than spirit. And Jesus, of course, comes back and changes that into the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law. And we also observe law, L-A-W, over L-O-R-E, which are the customs of the land, the historical learning and teaching of the way things work. The second stage of our belief in the divine, in our religion, in the ancient days, this is still 10,000 years ago, is the concept of the goddess as the mother and the wife of the god. So we've got the mother goddess, and she becomes the mother of the god, or the goddess, another goddess, and then if there's a god, she becomes the wife of the god. So she's the pivotal point of the cyclical nature of life. She gives birth to the god, and then she marries the god and gives birth again. And this, I think, probably came around when humanity realised that men actually had a part in procreation. And it not really meaning incest, though it sometimes sounds like that, because we're talking about gods and goddesses and myths and legends. We're not talking about physical beings actually having sex with each other. So it's not going around saying, please have sex with your mother or please have sex with your child. Honestly, it's not. And there are so many legends of this cycle of the mother bringing new life out of death. And we have the story of Isis and Osiris. This is the Egyptian pantheon of gods. Isis is the wife of Osiris. Osiris is killed, and Isis finds his body, puts it back together again, and conceives her son Horus of the life force from her husband's body. And if we look at the Hebrew temple, there are two pillars in the Hebrew temple. There's the feminine one, known as the Asherah. This is the first temple, not the second one. And the masculine one, known as Yahweh. So we know that there was a goddess in the first Hebrew temple. And we also believe that to the goddess were made offerings of wine, which represented blood, which was sacred in those days. And to the god, offerings were made of bread, which represented the yeast expanding and growing. Now, the goddess and the god were aspects of the one in the Holy of Holies of the temple, the first temple. The one was revered, honoured and worshipped. But just outside the Holy of Holies was the acknowledgement of the masculine and the feminine, the two pillars of the Tree of Life, and how the two of those are needed for the process of creation. And we know that the goddess was there because she's mourned in the prophets, specifically in Jeremiah, but also in Isaiah. And in Jeremiah, there's a quotation, which is Jeremiah 44:18. Since we left off burning incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out drink offerings unto her, we have wanted all things and have been consumed by the sword and by the famine. And we'll be talking a lot more about the work of Dr. Margaret Barker next week when we look at the first Hebrew temple. But she believes, and I think there's good evidence to support this, that some aspects of Christianity were an effort to take the Jewish nation back to the teachings of the first temple, honouring the divine feminine. Which, of course, if you look at the story in Christianity and our obsession with Mary Magdalene, we see the Virgin Mary as the mother of the god and Mary Magdalene ideally as the wife of the god. though she's actually his soulmate rather than his wife. And that's probably why we love the Da Vinci Code so much, because we want Mary Magdalene to have the child as a god. Because somewhere wired into our primeval consciousness is this very ancient belief of the cycle of life of the mother and the wife of the god. And the goddess resurrects the god. And I guess the god eventually learns not to like that. That could be one of the reasons why it all changed. We've got the story of Isis. We've also got Ishtar in Babylonia. The goddess Ishtar is in the centre picture on slide number 10. That picture is also used to demonstrate Lilith, who we'll be talking about next week, who is the demonisation of the divine feminine. But in Babylonia, it was said that Ishtar had to take an annual pilgrimage into the darkness to awaken her consort Tammuz and bring him back up into the light. And that would be the turning of the seasons, winter to spring to summer. In Greek myth, we've got a similar one with Persephone going down into Hades and Demeter, her mother, mourning her. And Persephone can only return to the land of the world for 6 months of the year because she eats six pomegranate seeds. Therefore, she has to return to the darkness 6 months of the year. But she still comes up as the year resurrects. Demeter mourns her each year, which is why we have winter. Then Persephone returns and Demeter is joyful and we get spring. There's also the story of Cybele and Attis. Cybele, also known as the Magna Mater, was one of the goddesses who eventually came to be revered in Rome. She was a curious creature. Her son Attis was also possibly her consort, and Attis dies and is resurrected. Attis dies because he self-mutilates himself. He cuts off his testicles, and the Galli, who were the priests of Cybele, also were self-mutilated. They cut off their own testicles and dressed up as women, which is actually one of the reasons why it may be that St. Paul was talking about women not teaching in public, because in those days the Galli were thought of as abominations in Rome and quite often were struck down and killed in the streets. So any woman proclaiming a new religion about a resurrected son of a virgin was going to be in deep trouble in Rome because they would mistake a woman with long flowing hair as one of the Galli, therefore an abomination. So these stories just go round and round and round and round. Now we're getting into the world of syncretism, which is a very impressive word, coming from synchronization, I suppose. As cultures merged, as we grew older, as goddesses and gods met up, as cultures met and merged, whether they just expanded and made friends or whether they conquered each other, the similarity between our pantheons of gods began to be noticed, because we all had gods of agriculture or war or love or fertility, because human nature is like that. We like this expansion, and we saw the gods in us and we saw gods in each other. So if we were sexual beings, the gods would be sexual beings. If we were warlike beings, the gods would be warlike beings. And therefore, each part of the pantheon would reflect some part of humanity. And these gods intermarried between different cultures, or they merged. But basically, because the patterns of creation are all the same, therefore the gods would all be the same, no matter what the cultures were. If they had gods, they would be gods of similar attributes. The Kushite god of Dedan was linked with Osiris and became Osiris. Dedan was a lion-headed god. There's a lot of lion-headed gods going around. We'll talk about Sekhmet in another section. The Romans, when they went into Egypt, they merged Hermes, or Mercury, with Anubis, and he became known as Hermanubis. There's a picture there on slide number 11 of a very strange-looking creature. In Mesopotamia, when they merged up with Greece, Astarte became Aphrodite. In Egypt, they merged Isis with Inanna from Sumeria and Ishtar from Assyria. And of course, Yahweh became merged with Zeus or Jupiter, which is a horrific abomination for both Judaism and Christianity. This idea that Yahweh could just become the king of the gods rather than just one god. Though, of course, the first commandment says, "Thou shalt have no other gods before my face." It doesn't mean that there are no other gods. And moving on from that to another strange word, which is theogony. This moves us forward in time quite some time to 700 BCE, and a poet called Hesiod, who came up with a theory of creation, which is very similar to the first one, but this is right within the Greek pantheon. So he's going back before time and picking up a very similar story to Sky Woman's, in that the beginning, the goddess, we think it was a goddess, but we're not quite sure. It might have been a being of indeterminate gender called Chaos, who is the primordial soup. And from Chaos is born Gaia, Erebus, Nyx, Tartarus, and Eros. Gaia and Nyx are feminine, the rest are masculine. These intermingle or intermarry and produce Uranus, Aether, Hemera, Aurea, and Pontus. And from them comes the pantheon of the gods. But the whole point of this is that it's originally the idea of the chaos, the primordial soup, which is the womb of creation, and everything flows from that. The third level of belief in divinity or the creation of Earth is a very different story. It's the goddess killed by the god and creation from the body of the goddess. So going from being the creatrix to the mother, she becomes the body of the Earth itself through her death. And this is the story of Tiamat, goddess of the primal depths, and Marduk. It's the Babylonian story. And this is relevant too, because it's in Babylon that the story of Lilith first emerged, the great demoness, who is the legendary first wife of Adam, who didn't exist, but the story came out to demonize the divine feminine after the fall of the first temple. And it would have suitedly come from Babylon, because they already had this story of Marduk chasing after and destroying Tiamat. Now, don't get me wrong, Tiamat was not necessarily a good thing. She was the chaos. She was the primeval depths, and she took the form of a dragon and swam in primal waters, and she threatened the gods. There were also gods at that point. So Marduk set off after her and slew her, defeating her with magic and powerful winds, and split her in two, cast one half of Tiamat into the sky to form the heavens, and the other half was cast down to the land, well, became the land, cast down to the earth to become our planet. So we go from a loving goddess of creation to a murdered goddess whose body becomes our land. And finally, the fourth aspect is God, the male, alone creating. And that is the one that we've been stuck with for the last 2,500 years. This is Yahweh, which is a distortion of the Hebrew teachings and a distortion even of the Old Testament as we have it today. Now, in the mystical tradition around Kabbalah, it says that Yahweh created from nothingness, which is another kind of form of primeval soup. But it's more like the Big Bang, in that there's nothing and then there's something. But certainly in this story, goddesses need not apply. I have to admit that when I teach creation as a Kabbalistic point of view, I do it from the feminine line, which is to say that a more easy way to understand it, which is that God was so happy and full of joy in its absoluteness and completeness that it wanted to have a baby, and that nothingness was the space that the goddess created as a womb and a uterus in which to breathe the light of creation. And that seems to make a lot of sense to a lot of people, rather than God wishing to behold God, which is the technical view, which is that God wished to see its reflection and wished to see it grow as a physical thing. That's quite a hard one to get your brain around, so I tend to use the feminine, but that's just because I can't get my brain around it. It's up to you, whichever one of the two you want to take on. But why did this happen? Why did the goddess fall into destruction and despair and animosity? Well, let's take a look at the statue of Sekhmet on the left-hand side of slide number 15 for a start. Sekhmet is the goddess of Gevurah on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. She represents what we would call Mars or Athena. She is the strong, powerful no. And Sekhmet, the lion-headed goddess, was the protector of Ra. She was also a great healer. No is a very great healer. In the modern world, allopathic medicine treats cancer with surgery or chemotherapy, both of which are major no's. I will cut you out or I will poison you. And that's pretty much the energy of that kind of healing. But Sekhmet's healing was a gentle no most of the time. However, she was capable of being incredibly fierce, and there is a legend about Sekhmet in that the humans started disrespecting Ra, who by then was the sun god, the powerful god of the Egyptians, and Sekhmet was sent to punish them for disrespecting their god. And to start with, she punished them with a certain amount of power and a certain amount of strength, just chiding and pointing things out, but they didn't listen. So she got crosser and crosser and crosser. And in the end, she was laying about her right, left and centre, causing plagues and destroying humanity. So Ra had to step in. And what he did was put pomegranate juice and beer in the River Nile so that Sekhmet would mistake it for blood and drink it, get drunk, fall over, fall asleep and wake up with a hangover and stop destroying humanity. So the divine feminine can get incredibly fierce and incredibly destructive. So that may be one of the reasons why she was ejected from the Hebrew temple and we became far more of a patriarchal society, because of destruction or cruelty, which is the negative aspect of the divine feminine. However, it's also very well relevant to point out that in those ancient days there was child sacrifice. And some of the legend is about the idea of the mother killing her son and then resurrecting him. Now, we don't know whether there were any actual legends that had any basis in fact that mothers killed their sons and then gave birth to other sons, but we do know that in ancient days, up to about 600-700 years before the New Testament times, that child sacrifice was honoured in many of the ancient times. And it may well have been that they bled through to the Hebrew temple. It may just simply be associated with the Hebrew temple because of the names of these synergist goddesses were very similar. If we look back at Jeremiah in the Hebrew Bible, Jeremiah 32:35, and they built the high places of Baal that are in the valley of Ben-Hinnom to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire to Molech, who's one of the pagan gods. And Jeremiah 19:5, they have built also the high places of Baal to burn their sons as offering to Baal. And here the Bible implies what modern archaeologists and anthropologists have recently discovered, that Molech and Baal represent the same god. Again, it's this synergy. So the wife of Baal was called Asherah, and the wife of Molech is Ashtaroth. Asherah and Ashtaroth sound very close to Ashrata, which was a name given to the divine feminine in the Hebrew temple. So whether or not there was child sacrifice, there certainly was a fear of child sacrifice. And that would certainly be enough to bring the divine feminine tumbling down. Interestingly, in Genesis, there's also the story of Abraham and Isaac. You probably know that Abraham's told by God to sacrifice Isaac. So he takes his son away and gathers firewood. And then at the last moment, a ram appears and he's told by an angel of the divine that he doesn't have to sacrifice Isaac and that the ram is there instead. Now, interestingly, that part of the story is written by the author of the Hebrew Testament known as E, who featured the Elohim, which is the aspect of the divine feminine, rather than the other writer who's J, who focused on Yahweh, Jehovah. So this story is where the Elohim tells Abraham to take Isaac and be prepared to sacrifice him, but then at the last minute says, it is not needed. Human sacrifice is not needed. So it's entirely possible that the whole story in Genesis is the divine feminine saying other cultures are sacrificing their children. Abraham, you come from another culture. You believe you have to sacrifice your son, but I, the divine goddess, say no, you do not need to. But even so, if that was the case, it wasn't sufficient and the divine feminine was banned from the temple. The dark side of the divine feminine is very negative, just like the overly light sign of the divine masculine is overly positive and dangerous. And I'm quoting here from a man called Danan Parry, whom we're going to come back to later, who wrote a wonderful book called Warriors of the Heart and spent a lifetime working on conflict resolution. And one of his main points was that there were always gender and sex roles and mother, father, child, parent, man, woman roles in conflict, and that we have to acknowledge these. And, of course, the feminine is referred to as the dark and the masculine is referred to as the light. And the dark is not necessarily bad, but if it's corrupted or toxic, it is. And Danan writes, if you can only own the light in you and not the dark, if you're focused on expansion and the patriarchy and you don't go down into the darkness and the wound in the feminine, then, Danan says, the dark will come to rule you. If you won't acknowledge your own shadow, you will project it onto others and you will call them bad and evil, the enemy. The world is not in a dilemma because of the bad guys. It's in this mess because of all the good guys running around projecting their unknown darkness onto others and then feeling justified in fixing them. Or if that doesn't work, killing them in the name of God, progress or peace. And that is a summing up of how serious we are in the fact that we have lost so much of the sacred feminine. We don't understand about suffering or death or the power of the darkness, so we hide it and it turns septic. So that's why it's so important to be doing this work. So there's a look at the creation stories of humanity. I hope it's been entertaining. We're going to stop the recording now because the next part is a meditation.